The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome to Memorable Moments in History. This week, we celebrate the anniversary of what came to be known as Seward's Folly. For it was in March of 1867 that U.S. Secretary of State William H. Seward signed a treaty with Russia for the purchase of Alaska for $7 billion. Despite the bargain price of roughly 2 cents an acre, the Alaskan purchase was ridiculed in Congress and in the press as Seward's Folly, Seward's Icebox, and President Andrew Johnson's Polar Bear Garden. The Tsarist government of Russia, which had established a presence in Alaska in the mid-18th century, first approached the United States about selling the territory during the administration of President James Buchanan. But negotiations were stalled by the outbreak of the Civil War. After 1865, Seward, a supporter of territorial expansion, was eager to acquire the tremendous landmass of Alaska, an area roughly one-fifth the size of the rest of the United States. He had some difficulty, however, making the case for the purchase of Alaska before the Senate, which ratified the treaty by a margin of just one vote on April 9, 1867. 6 months later, Alaska was formally handed over from Russia to the United States. Despite a slow start in U.S. settlement, the discovery of gold in 1898 brought a rapid influx of people to the territory, and Alaska, rich in natural resources, has contributed to American prosperity ever since. It was this week on March 30, 1870, that the 15th Amendment was adopted. Following its ratification by the requisite three-fourths of the states, the 15th Amendment, granting African-American men the right to vote, is formally adopted into the U.S. Constitution. Passed by Congress the year before, the amendment reads, "The rights of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." One day after it was adopted, Thomas Peterson Mundy of Perth Amboy, New Jersey, became the first African-American to vote under the authority of the 15th Amendment. In 1867, the Republican-dominated Congress passed the first Reconstruction Act over President Andrew Johnson's veto, dividing the South into five military districts and outlining how the new governments based on universal manhood suffrage would be established. With the adoption of the 15th Amendment in 1870, a politically mobilized African-American community joined with white allies in southern states to elect the Republican Party to power, which brought about radical changes across the South. By late 1870, all the former Confederate states had been readmitted to the Union. Most were controlled by the Republican Party, thanks to the support of African-American voters. In the same year, Hiram Rhodes Revels, a Republican from Natchez, Mississippi, became the first African-American ever to sit in Congress. Although African-American Republicans never obtained political office in proportion to their overwhelming electoral majority, Revels and a dozen other African-American men served in Congress during Reconstruction, more than 600 served in state legislatures, and many more held local offices. However, in the late 1870s, the Southern Republican Party vanished with the end of Reconstruction, and Southern state governments effectively nullified the 14th and 15th Amendments, stripping Southern African-Americans of the right to vote. It would be nearly a century before the nation would again attempt to establish equal rights for African Americans in the South. It was also this week that the longest strike in Major League Baseball history ended. Major League Baseball players were sent back to work after the longest strike ended on this day, March the 31st, 1995. Because of the strike, the 1994 World Series was canceled, and it was the first time baseball did not crown a champion in 89 years. This is also the week that we celebrate Dr. Doctor Day on March 31st. Because from this day on, surgery would no longer be painful, at least while it was being performed. Dr. Crawford W. Long performed the first operation while a patient was anesthetized by ether on this day in 1842, as he removed a tumor from the neck of a boy. Crawford had been observing several partygoers under the influence of nitrous oxide and sulfuric ether. Those folks were feeling no pain, and Crawford's patient literally felt no pain as the good doctor removed a tumor from the man's neck using the party concoction. This event has been celebrated as Doctor's Day since this day in 1933. The idea of setting aside a day to honor physicians was conceived by Eudora Brown Almond, wife of Dr. Charles B. Almond, and doctors throughout the United States celebrate in Dr. Crawford W. Long's honor and in honor of ether as an anesthetic. Give a doctor a red carnation today. It's the official designated flower of Doctor's Day. It was on this day in 1806 that Joseph Bonaparte, brother of Napoleon, was proclaimed King of Naples. And interestingly enough, on this day in 1814, British and its allies against Napoleon Bonaparte marched in triumph into Paris. In 1856 this week, the Treaty of Paris was signed, ending the Crimean War and guaranteeing the integrity of Ottoman Turkey. And in 1858, Hyman L. Lippmann, a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, patented the pencil, which did have an eraser attached. It was in 1870 this week that the United States Congress readmitted Texas to the Union after it had succeeded in 1861 to join the Confederate States. And in 1987, Vincent van Gogh's Sunflowers brought in $39,850,000, more than triple the record for a painting at auction. It was sold on the 134th anniversary of the artist's birth. Singer Don McLean wrote and sang a musical tribute to the artist titled Vincent in April of 1972. Hitting the charts in 1963, He's So Fine, recorded by the Chiffons, jumped into the top spot on the Billboard's record charts on this date and stayed in the number one spot for 4 weeks. And in 1964, one of the best-known game shows on television, Jeopardy, developed by Merv Griffin, first aired on NBC TV. Host Art Fleming never missed a show in 2,500 programs. In 1970, Secretariat would win horse racing's Triple Crown. In 1973 was born. And in 1909, in New York City, the Queensborough Bridge, the first double-decker bridge, opened. Then in 1971, the Bee Gees were given a gold record for Lonely Days. When playing the gold record, they heard the song at a faster speed and said, "Hey, this sounds like disco." The rest is part of Saturday Night Fever history. Then in 1973, Ken Norton defeated Muhammad Ali in a 12-round split decision. Ali had his jaw broken during the fight. Birthdays of significant note this week include the father of modern philosophy, René Descartes in 1596. The author of I Think, Therefore I Am died February 11, 1650. 1809 saw the birth of Nikolai Gogol, playwright and novelist of Dead Souls. And in 1823, Mary Chestnut, author of A Diary from Dixie. She died in 1886. 1922 saw the birth of Richard Paul Kiley, the Emmy Award-winning actor who appeared in The Thornbirds in 1983 and Blackboard Jungle. He also appeared in The Bad Sea, Looking for Mr. Goodbar. He died March the 5th, 1999. 1927 saw the birth of Cesar Chavez, the labor leader who started the National Farm Workers Association by organizing migrant farm workers. Lefty William Orville Frizzell was born this week in 1928. Along with Liz Claiborne, the fashion designer in 1929, and John Jakes, author of California Gold, and In the Big Country in 1932. The actor Richard Chamberlain was born in 1934. Many of you will remember him as Dr. Kildare. He also appeared in The Thornbirds, Centennial, Shogun, The Towering Inferno, and Julius Caesar. This week also marks the anniversary of the birth in 1934 of Shirley Jones, the singer-actress in Carousel of the Music Man. In 1935, the birth of Herb Albert, the bandleader of the Tijuana Brass. And in 1943, Christopher Walken, also known as Ronald Walken, the actor in The Deer Hunter, Batman Returns, Wayne's World 2, and Pulp Fiction. Finally this week, the birth of Al Gore in 1948, the actress Ree Perlman, also in 1948, and the football star Ed Marinaro in 1950, was a member of the Minnesota Vikings, and also played in Super Bowl VIII and IX. Many of you will recall him for his roles in Hill Street Blues, Sisters, and Dancing with Danger. You probably aren't familiar with the name Ingvar Kamprad, but you are familiar with the home furnishing retail chain he founded this week in 1943 called IKEA. The acronym IKEA is made up of his initials IK, plus those of Elmtard, the farm where he was born, and Agonard, a nearby village. As a boy, Kamprad earned a profit buying matches in bulk and reselling them individually. When he was 17, his father gave him a cash reward for performing well in school, and he used the money to establish IKEA. Kamprad has admitted that his dyslexia played a large part in the inner workings of the company. For example, the Swedish-sounding names of the furniture sold by IKEA were originally chosen by Kamprad because he had difficulty remembering the stock keeping units or numbers. Kamprad has lived in Appalingis, Switzerland since 1976, and according to an interview with TSR, the French-language Swiss TV broadcaster, Kamprad drives a 15-year-old Volvo, flies only economy class, and encourages IKEA employees to always write on both sides of a piece of paper. In addition, Kamprad has been known to visit IKEA for a cheap meal. He's also known to buy Christmas paper and presents in the post-Christmas sales. While Kamprad's frugality is well documented, it is also an important part of the carefully managed image presented to the IKEA employees and the general public. He less frequently mentions that he owns a villa in an upmarket part of Switzerland, a large country estate in Sweden, and a vineyard in the Provence, France, or that he drove a Porsche for several years. While working with furniture manufacturers in Poland early in his career, Kamprad became an alcoholic. He has, however, stated that his drinking is now under control. The Dutch-registered Stichting Ingra Foundation is named after Kamprad and owns Ingra Holding, the parent company for all IKEA stores. The charitable foundation was reported by the business newspaper The Economist in May of 2006 to be technically the world's wealthiest charity, with an estimated value of at least $36 billion in 2006, larger than Bill and the Melinda Gates Foundation. But its primary purpose is by some believed to be a corporate tax avoidance and anti-takeover protection for IKEA, and Kamprad is the chairman of the foundation. While generally a private person, Ingvar Kamprad has published a few notable works. His first detailed the IKEA concept of frugality and enthusiasm in a manifesto entitled A Testament of a Furniture Dealer. Written in 1976, it has since been considered the fundamental ideology of the IKEA furniture retail concept. He also worked with Swedish journalist Bertil Torkel on the book Leading by Design, The IKEA Story. And in the autobiographical account, he further describes his philosophies and the trials and triumphs of the founding of IKEA. In 1994, the personal letters of the Swedish fascist activist Per Engdahl were made public after his death, and it was revealed that Kamprad had joined Engdahl's pro-Nazi group in 1942. Kamprad had raised funds for and recruited members to said group at least as late as September of 1945. When Kamprad quit the group is unknown, but he remained a friend of Engdahl until the early 1950s. Since the public revelation, Kamprad has said that he bitterly regrets that part of his life, calling it his greatest mistake. He subsequently wrote letters of apology to all IKEA employees of Jewish descent. It's believed that the fact that IKEA is one of the few retailers to have a store in Israel, even though it also does business with the Arab world, reflects an attempt to temper this controversy. Finally, I'll leave you with this quote by Abraham Lincoln. Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. This has been Stephen J. Lowenstein reading to you. Hope you'll join me soon for another edition of Memorable Moments in History.